Being black, being African, being queer, beauty and the dignity of beauty is not something that's always extended to me. Through my work, there's an opportunity to dignify myself and to dignify each other by rendering us as beautiful. In that context, beauty becomes such a protest. It becomes like an act of reclamation. And so I move with that awareness that as superficial as people might think it is, that beauty is also quite radical and quite a powerful tool.
Sunny Dolet is one of Africa's leading fashion thinkers, working as a curator, stylist, creative director, and production designer. Since co-founding Nairobi's Nest Collective and publishing the pivotal book, Not African Enough, he has gone on to produce exhibitions, films, and performances worldwide. Their documentary project, Stories of Our Lives, was internationally acclaimed for archiving Kenya's queer voices, despite being banned at home. He helped to shape the V&A's landmark show, Africa Fashion, and has joined the Business of Fashion 500, class of 23. Sunny is driven by one purpose, which he explains like this. Everything I do is to expand our understanding of beauty and design. So people look further and harder to see the whole of the continent, not just the usual three or four places. Sunny Dolet, welcome to the African Imaginary Podcast.
Thank you.
We're going to start with a little game called Keep a Toss.
Okay.
Shall we start?
Let's go for it.
Okay.
Let's start with the circle.
So remember, keep a toss.
Extrovert.
Toss.
Toss.
Okay.
it's going to be a hard toss.
Let's try this one. Ooh.
Social climber. Ooh, toss.
Toss. That's okay.
It. Yeah.
Like where this is going.
Raver. Ooh, I think that's going to have to be a toss as well.
A toss. You try. So not doing too well this morning.
Dancer.
Dancer.
I'll say keep. So I think there's a point in my life when, like, and had you asked me this question, you'd be like, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I think that raver would definitely be here.
Okay.
But as I've grown older, I've kind of like mellowed. But I think I still enjoy dancing. Definitely not as much as I used to when I was like early 20s. But yeah, I'll like go out every now and again, have a nice little dance.
Okay. Well, there's certainly a difference between being a raver and being
and
a dancer. It clearly comes with age. Ooh. Snob.
Oh my God.
Keep it toss.
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 I think that there is this perception around about people who work in fashion as being very kind of like snobbish.
Hmm.
And I think that there's a couple of reasons that inform that perception. But I would like to think that I'm not a snob, but I also understand where that perception comes from when it comes to people who work in fashion.
So what word would you use instead? Maybe discerning?
I'd say discerning, but also I'm an introvert.
Mm.
And I think that the line can be a little bit thin between kind of like being perceived as a snob versus an introvert.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love the distinction. Okay, you choose one.
Okay, let's go for this one. Student.
Student.
Keith.
Keith. Yeah.
I'm naturally a very curious person. I think curiosity has always fueled me and my work. There's always like, I enjoy being able to like question and interrogate things.
Mm.
And I think that there's such humility in being a student and staying curious. So I hope that I'm able to stay curious for my entire time here.
Yeah, an eternal student, right? And are you a student in the academic sense or just more in the life experience sense?
Both.
Both.
I'd say both.
Okay, I have one.
Okay, hermit, keep.
Keep.
I'm not proud to keep that one, but definitely keep. I think, again, because I am an introvert and I spend so much time in my head, I really enjoy kind of like solitude because it allows me to sit with thoughts and think things through. I try to be sort of like as balanced as I can be. Sometimes I'm like, okay, it's been like 3 days and I haven't left the house. I need to like leave the house and socialize. But I would say that I am a little bit of a hermit.
Are you one of those people who gets re-energized by solitude?
I am, 100%. I think, for me at least, there's something that comes, there's a clarity and a rest that comes in solitude that I really enjoy.
Hmm.
And so I actually find it very re-energizing.
Love that. Shall we keep going?
Let's keep going.
Let's try a few more.
Romantic.
Hmm. Keep
Let's say keep.
Keep.
Let's say keep.
Okay.
I will give the disclaimer
that I think that day of romantic is really, for me, is really interesting to think about, because the kind of romantic expression that we see on TV or we read about in novels feels very, very narrow. Mm. And again, going back to kind of like being an introvert, I think I have very romantic gestures. I think that they're romantic, but they fall outside of your kind of like textbook romance. Mm. I suppose there are some moments or some scenarios where a romantic gesture has been maybe read as a kind gesture, but has been intended from my position as a romantic gesture. And so it's always interesting for me to kind of think about what romance and the expression of it looks like.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I would take it a moment.
I love that. And I think it's different for everyone, right?
Yeah.
And I guess there is a part of romance that shows up as kindness, actually.
That's kind of the foundation. But I also think that we're so used to seeing this sort of like grand romantic gestures. Mm. So like, you know, whether it's the, I don't know, like helicopter, mountaintop proposal, like a flash mob. I think like all of those gestures have become so accessible to us that maybe that starts to become the kind of like primary gesture that we think about.
Yeah.
Whereas the kind of like quieter, gentler someone, so a fridge magnet that made them think of you and so they got it for you, which is, yeah. And I think you're absolutely right in saying that kindness and consideration are kind of like the building blocks of romance, I think.
I love that. So you pick a card.
Okay, I'll pick that one. Athlete.
Athlete. Keep it us.
Well, so let's keep it here in the center for a moment.
Okay.
And I will say that, had you asked me this, like, 15 years ago, it would have been an obvious toss.
Okay.
Because over the past like 10 years, I think specifically, I've had a really interesting renegotiation with my body. I think growing up, I was like the most unathletic person you could think of. Mm. But I also think that was informed by the kind of dynamics on the pitch.
Okay.
I think there's a tendency to look at people who are not interested in sport as just not being interested in sport. Mm. But what I've found is, so maybe 2019, 2018, I started going to the gym very, very loosely. I started by doing yoga before.
Okay.
And that period allowed me to connect with my body in a way that I hadn't before. Mm. And it made me aware of my body that I wasn't before. And I suppose now I have a gym routine. I'm like, I'm fairly active and I really enjoy it. But I think if you'd have told like teenage me that I'd be like at the gym lifting weights, I'd be like, absolutely no way. And so I think there's really a case to be made around these sort of like fitness spaces and active spaces to have more grace for people who maybe might be disinterested at first, or just like only lightly curious. Because I think that like once there's safety in that space and you give something a shot, you might be surprised.
Yeah.
I think I'll keep it.
I think gyms can be intimidating, right?
Like
I always say, I can tell how fit a person is by how immaculately decked out they are for the gym.
Yes.
I find the real fitness fanatics tend to not care. They just go and work out. And then you get those people who are quite considered. But this is my personal bias.
No, but it's true. And I think just this ties into this element of performance, right? Because that whole thing, like having like the perfect outfit, the best shoes, like a cap and all these bands, the perfect water bottle. They're all elements of performance. And that performance can be really intimidating, because if you're someone who is just thinking, I just want to go use a treadmill, and you're like, all I have are these Converse, then you can feel reluctant to access that space and, you know, so like take that jump.
Okay, dramacy. Keep with us.
I'll say Taurus, and I hope that everyone agrees with me.
Taurus? What is that laugh about?
I think there's a tendency for people to think that anyone and everyone who works in fashion has this sort of like drama queen persona. And it's funny that snob is there, because I think the two things that people think of like people who work in fashion are is that either they're drama queens or like really spoilt and bratty, or that they're snobs. So I'll say a hard toss, because I don't think I'm a drama queen. And certainly not a snob. But I also feel like perhaps part of that, and this is, I'll say that there's absolutely people who work in fashion who are snobs or drama queens. They're the
social climbers or extroverts, who are ravers.
But I also think that part of that perception comes from like fashion as a space, as a medium, as an industry is quite intimidating, because what the fashion kind of industry does and what fashion media specifically does is that it weaponizes this kind of literacy around clothing against people who don't hold the same literacy, right? Because I think that there's an intelligence that people build, there's a fluency that people build when it comes to clothing over time. And what fashion media does is it takes this fluency and kind of castigates people who don't have the same fluency. Mm-hmm. And so you create this really uncomfortable power dynamic. And so unsurprisingly, there is a perception of people who work in fashion that they're snobbish because, you know, they're going to judge me. They're going to like, maybe they don't like my shoes.
Mm.
And so there's always a kind of discomfort.
Mm.
I find that sometimes when I meet someone and I say that I work in fashion, that they become anxious and they become suddenly uncertain of the choices that they made this morning. And they start apologizing for their shoes or like their dress and like, you know, kind of diminishing and saying, oh, you know, I'm just wearing an old dress. I didn't have time.
Yeah, this old thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know. And I think it's because of that power dynamic.
Incredible. So as someone who is well-versed in fashion, I mean, how should one engage with that? Do you like to see people who express themselves in a non-performative way, but just as a form of self-expression? Or are you of more of the considered kind? Do you like to see some consideration when a person engages with fashion?
I think I'm always more interested in context and intention, right? Because I think when you think about dressing and the act of dressing, I like to think of clothing as a form of architecture. It's the architecture of the body. And that when you dress yourself, you're placing this architecture over yourself to kind of communicate to the world who you are at any given time and how you want to be seen. And so while I think context and intention are important, I feel like that's the only way you can understand the choices and the decisions that informed that specific architecture at that moment. If someone's going for a job interview, you know the intention and you know the context. And so you're able to understand and read it a lot better. But if you're unaware of intention and context, then I think that it's really difficult to read successfully.
Yeah.
And which is why I feel like the Fashion Police format is also so unfair, because it's, you know, it's a format that's been created to judge and ridicule people's choices without taking into account context and intention, which I think is the only way to read fashion. I'm always interested to find out why people are wearing what they're wearing more than anything and how they feel about it, how it makes them feel.
Mm. The story behind it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a form of storytelling
It's a form of storytelling.
Romantic hermit student dancer. That sounds
interesting
like
mix of things.
A whole human being. So we have a convention on this podcast where we like to ask our guests the meaning of their names. So indulge me and tell me, what is the meaning of your name, Sunny Dolat?
That's a good question. I think like Sunny is just Sunny.
Okay.
I never really had a chance to ask my mom and my dad why they named me Sunny. Also because between like I have two older siblings and like my name is a little bit of an outlier. It's a little bit unusual. So I have Indian heritage and Sunny is a fairly common name among Indians. So I know that there's kind of like that element. And then my son name, which is Dolat, but actually pronounced Dolat, translates to like wealth in Hindi.
Okay.
Like Sunny wealth.
And I understand that you are a quarter Maasai.
Yes.
and that there is a unique belief system around the naming of children. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So as I mentioned, I have Indian heritage, I have Maasai heritage. So my dad was half Indian, half Maasai. My mom was half Ugandan, half Rwandan. A bit of context about like the Indian heritage. So my dad's grandfather was among the Indians that were brought into East Africa by the British to build the railway. And so that's kind of where my Indian heritage stems from. And he was sort of like, my great-grandfather, that is, was working kind of like south of the country and met a half Chaga, half Maasai woman he fell in love with and, you know, continued to have kids. But among the Maasai, there's a really interesting naming system and it's kind of shifted significantly over the past couple of years. A while ago, the Maasai would only name children, I think, after the age of 9.
Okay.
And part of that was informed by that there was such high infant mortality among the Maasai.
Oh, wow.
Because access to healthcare was limited, access to like proper birthing was also limited, and so infant mortality was quite high. And I think there was something to try and maybe comfort mothers by delaying the sort of like naming, because then you're delaying or limiting the level of connection between that child and community, maybe in hopes that if there is a loss, that it's easier to navigate. And there's a really beautiful saying around like the statement that like death cannot see a child with no name, which is equally poetic and heartbreaking. And so then the naming of a child and the naming of children was such a significant milestone, because then it's like the child has passed this really dangerous window. And now you can fully embrace them. They can join community. But thankfully, you know, the infant mortality is a lot lower. So children are being named a lot sooner. And also the state intervenes in these sort of like cultural practices, because now the practice is that like once a child is born in a hospital, you have to register like a birth certificate and a name needs to go in a certificate.
Yeah.
And so the practice, as far as I know, is really isn't that common anymore.
And so who were you up until the age of 9? What is a child referred to?
By the time that I was born, also I was born in Nairobi, and so I was named from birth.
Okay.
And I think the common practice was just sort of like nicknames or like placeholder names.
So take me back to how you grew up. So you have a very fascinating lineage where you've spoken about the fact that your father was half Maasai, half Indian. Your mother was half Rwandan and half Ugandan. And you were mostly raised in a household with four aunts practicing Sikhism, which is a religion. So how did this tapestry of different nationalities influence you from a cultural perspective, as well as your sense of style?
So I know that this might sound a little bit cliche, but growing up, I guess I wasn't really aware of how unusual our family setup was.
Okay.
Because it was the only thing I knew. It was my primary reference point. But as I grew older and kind of went to school and made friends and started to see other family dynamics, I realized that, you know, like our setup was a little bit unusual but quite unique. And I think that as I've grown older, I have such appreciation for that really unique dynamic and the way that it shaped me. So as you mentioned, I was raised by my four aunts, and that's my dad's sisters. So, you know, it's like, it was a kind of like tough upbringing, because I always say that I'd always report to like a panel of parents.
When you come home with your school reports.
It's like a panel waiting for me. I have to answer to every single one. It was like my four aunts, my grandmother and my mom. So it's like six, like really strong and like really strict women. And I think that in and of itself was really interesting and certainly tough to navigate, because like six different personalities, six like... also trying to understand and establish a sense of like hierarchy and like respect that's nuanced and all of these things. But also culturally and just sort of like observing them. So I was raised Indian and raised Sikh. So I grew up eating Indian food, and that was like pretty much, I remember, I think I had my first taste of beef like maybe 16.
Oh, wow. Okay. So mostly vegetarian.
Well, not really vegetarian, because the thing with Sikhs is that they don't eat beef, but they eat like chicken, fish, and mutton and all those things. Even just from like from a food perspective, I remember going to school and sort of like speaking with other kids, or like maybe going to visit other kids and realizing that like, oh, okay, they eat this, we don't eat this. And just like being like, okay, there's a difference. That's interesting to think about. But also like watching my aunts, watching my mom, watching my grandma just sort of like be and how they would dress and kind of like adorn themselves, the kind of like rituals and practice of adornment and dressing and beauty and the way that they instrumentalized culture, heritage through dress fundamentally. I think really shaped my perspective and my perception of beauty and clothing and what it does and what it means for people, but also what it holds, right? Because then... especially for people who are multicultural, then clothing starts to become such potent symbols of that culture. So maybe it's that someone is wearing a sari or a sarwal kameez, and that becomes a symbol of that heritage, and that they can switch from that to wearing like a Maasai shuka, and then they're signaling another part of themselves. Also like seeing how it's then utilized in that way for me was really interesting.
I remember seeing some pictures that you've shared publicly of your aunts, and they look like very stylish dresses. But what was the predominant sense of style? Was it very modern or quite traditional?
It was very modern.
Okay.
So one of my favorite pastimes to do is like I go to my aunt's place and I like pick up photo albums and just, you know, I like to think of photo albums as like the Instagram of the time.
Yeah,
and like
yeah.
when you open it up, it almost looks like a little bit like a, like an Instagram grid.
Yeah.
You know, these are images from like kind of like late 70s to about like late 90s. The style was super modern. It felt like catching glimpses of like Living Single or like Fresh Prince. It was always very representative of the time.
Yeah.
But always having this sort of like cultural element, right?
Mm.
And I think that that's true up till now. It's like the way that a lot of Africans dress is this balance between expressing some part of their culture or nationality, but also being modern and contemporary. And so it's really interesting in between, like straddling both areas.
Very much like how our generation actually dresses today, right?
Exactly.
Borrowing elements of our traditional dress.
Yeah.
And incorporating it with a modern sense of style.
Yeah.
And in an environment where you don't have the traditional mother and father and you're raised by your four aunts and your grandmother, how is hierarchy established? Was your grandmother the matriarch of the family?
She was up until she passed away, and that was in 1995. I must have been like 7 years. And so after she passed away, the person who became the matriarch was actually my eldest aunt, who I and all of us call mom.
Okay.
So also seeing how the hierarchy kind of like shifts is interesting.
From generation to generation.
This kind of like figurative passing of the mantle and the responsibilities that come with that. But also I think among the kids, the movement of title, right? So like I lost my mom when I was 9. And up until then, like, she was mom. My aunts were all auntie so-and-so, and my grandma was my nanny. And after my mom passed away, then the mom title moved.
Mm.
And now, you know, like, depending on the day, like everyone gets called mom because it's like, again, like this panel of parents, but it's also like a panel of mothers because I was raised by all of them. Like, I think sometimes thinking about like losing parents at such a young age can be difficult.
Mm, absolutely.
But I also consider myself so incredibly lucky because like, yeah, how lucky am I to have had 6 mothers, you know?
Incredible.
Yeah, so I'm very soft for them.
The village that raised you. And do they all still live in Kenya today?
They do, in the same house.
Oh,
so it's still very much
really?
A panel. Yes.
And so when you go home, are you still little Sunny to them?
I mean, thankfully, I think I'm still very much little Sunny, but thankfully, the sort of like panel dynamics have softened a little.
Okay.
I think one of my favorite things about growing older is when you, like, there's this like shift in the relationship between you and your parents where they start to see you as an adult and they're not really babying you anymore. Like, they might baby you, but they're like, oh wow, like you're actually kind of like a grown-up.
Yeah.
And they almost start treating you like a friend or like a confidant. So sometimes my eldest aunt mom will call me like in the middle of the day to tell me like something just so random, like, so I don't want to say pointless, but like, you know, it's just like, it's like a little piece of gossip.
Yes. Like she's chatting to her friend.
Yeah, exactly. Beautiful. And I remember the first time that happened, I was like, it caught me so off guard because I was like, this is like our dynamic has shifted, right?
Yeah.
And I realized that they saw me as a grown up and as an adult. And that really felt like an accomplishment.
Sure. So in a household full of women, what was celebrated when you were a child and what was punished?
Bad behavior was punished.
Okay.
It's funny because they're not a fan of bad grades, but I think the whole position was you can always do more. You can study harder. You can always become better.
Mm.
But bad behavior for them was like there was a hard line there. And I think it was this idea that like I was a symbol of them by extension, as an extension of them, right? So if I'm doing some random things in school or like I've like gone out and like done something reckless at a neighbor's place, I think they also would carry that shame and embarrassment.
I see.
And so it was always like, listen, like grades, it's fine. You can study more, you can get like extra classes, all these things, but like behavior for them and still remains quite fundamental and quite important. So bad behavior was always punished. What was celebrated? Good grades were celebrated.
I can imagine, yeah.
Good grades are always celebrated.
Good behavior.
And good behavior was celebrated too.
I mean, I like to ask people that question because it's so revealing about what was valued and, you know, how certain value systems were placed in them just by the things that are celebrated and the things that were punished.
Yeah.
But I also like to ask people around the question of who was your first enemy to try and understand whether it was a person, whether it was an idea. So, Sunny Dolat, who was your first enemy?
Whew. I think I had a couple of teachers in primary school that I really didn't get along with. Maybe calling them an enemy feels like a little bit of a stretch, but there was always a tension. There's like, two teachers I can think of who we just never could get along.
Hmm.
And I think it was also because like I was quite a sensitive child. And I suppose in some ways I was quite an unusual child. You know, this is like back in the 90s. I think now there's such expansive vocabulary for these sort of like, I don't want to call them peculiarities,
yeah,
but peculiarities that we find in children, whether it's like something around behavior or like academic capability. Whereas when I was in primary school, there wasn't that kind of awareness and vocabulary and understanding. And so I think there was always this idea that if, for instance, like a student or a child wasn't performing well in class, it was just like because they're, for lack of a better word, just like stupid, right? And sometimes the teachers would kind of like move like that, right? Now, I think we are all, at least I hope, everyone's really aware of how damaging some of those labels and some of the language can be for children. And there's such a need for nuance and understanding for that people respond to education in different ways and that people learn differently and that there wasn't the same nuance back then. There was like one way of studying, right?
Yeah.
And that was it.
I mean, it's always interesting to think about whether your career is sometimes as a direct result of you rebelling against, you know, the system, the education system you came up through, or whether it's actually informed it in some way. And given the tension you describe, what was that like for you? What was school like for you?
School was a mixed bag, right? I had some lovely experiences. I made some lifelong friends. But I think for a long time, there was, again, the education system, and I think it's changing now, but the education system in Kenya at the time was so fixated on this idea of being book smart, right? And especially around like what people consider the core subjects, so like math, physics, or like your sciences, and any interest in things like English or literature or history were thought of, like considered as like less than. And so it was always this idea of like, okay, you have to do well in math. If it's high school, it's like chemistry, physics, biology. And those were, for me, my worst subjects. The places that I really used to excel was in like in the arts. So whether it's like arts and languages. And that took me a long time to navigate. And I think in high school, I got a much clearer sense of where my strengths lie. And thankfully, because I went to an international high school, I was able to lean into my strengths and focus on languages and focus on literature and focus on the arts. And I think that really set me up for what I'm doing now.
Mm.
And I'm thankful for that experience, because had I sort of like remained in a system that was so rigid and so fixated on this excellence in math and the sciences, I think it would have been hard. And I'm not sure who I would have become.
Absolutely. And I think it takes a long time to unravel that if you haven't had a good schooling experience, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we talk a bit about the things you discover the minute you leave your immediate environment and that you realize the world is a different place. So for me, it was the schooling experience. I got to university and realized not everybody necessarily loved the schools they came from, because I had a wonderful time at school and then got to learn that, you know,
it's not the case for everyone.
Exactly. Which I thought was quite a powerful thing in terms of how it informs who you become. So let's cut to today. So you're a curator, a stylist, a creative director, a production designer. I once heard you say that depending on the day, you might
change the title.
Any one of those titles. Exactly. So your world revolves around visual storytelling through fashion and clothing. But who first planted or nurtured the seed of who you were to become?
That's a big question. I think it's a couple of people. I think high school for me was great because it allowed me to really zero in on my interest in working within the creative arts. At the time, I thought I wanted to become a fashion designer. And was sort of like, you know, setting myself up to study fashion and sort of like explore what that would look like. And then maybe like my first year in campus, a close friend, Jim Chuchu, who's a wonderful photographer. Jim at the time was working primarily as a photographer, and I think I must have found him on Facebook and sent him a message. And, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm a huge fan of your image making. So Jim and I would later do some work together. And that became my entry into styling. He was working on a shoot and they didn't have a stylist. He was like, listen, do you want to come and style? And I was like, I mean, I guess. Tell me what you need, right? That entry sort of opened up a world of possibility that I was completely unaware of. I'd spent a number of years really thinking about and like working towards becoming a designer. And suddenly I was introduced into this new expression that still utilized clothing, but clothing that I didn't have to make.
Mm.
And it felt like what I was doing and like the work of styling is a kind of retranslation and recontextualization of clothing that's already been made.
Mm.
And that was really exciting for me. And so I was like, okay, the plan at the time was like, okay, let me spend some time doing the styling while I find my way into like actually making clothing. So Jim is definitely someone. I majored in visual arts in my A-levels.
Okay.
Did a lot of photography, a lot of like painting, a little bit of sculpture. And those 2 years sort of experimenting also opened me up to different creative practice, kind of like ways of making and ways of thinking that I think, again, were really important and really useful building blocks to how I work now, which is having this kind of like freedom when it comes to medium and not really being fixated and feeling locked within a certain medium, but having the freedom to move between photography and styling or fashion to sculpture to film to sound.
So let's talk about the Nest Collective and your partnership and chosen family of 12. What was at the heart of the Nest Collective and what was your role in the beginning?
So I have a background in hospitality management, which is actually what I studied in university. I worked in hospitality for 4 years after uni. And during my time in hospitality, obviously, I'd already met Jim and we were working together on and off on different projects. I had met Njoki because we were in A-levels together. I had met George and we had done some stuff together. So among the core team, the founding team of four, there was already an existing relationship, but also an existing working dynamic and collaborative dynamic. So I was working at the hotel and Jim and George, there's this thought that had been brewing around forming an arts collective. At the time, and this was back in 2012.
Okay.
14 years ago, just a long time ago. At the time, you know, what we observed within the creative ecosystem in Nairobi was a lack of a gathering space or like an absence of a gathering space for artists and audiences who were interested in, I guess, newer forms or like, yeah, newer forms or mediums of art. So your photographies, your films, your sound, because the spaces existing at the time were more catered to artists working in more traditional mediums, so painting, sculpture, but these sort of like newer mediums, there wasn't really anywhere that was presenting that kind of work.
Mm.
And so we set up initially as a space really to platform and present these formats of work. I think maybe like August or September of 2012, I'm getting lost on the exact date, I handed in my notice at the hotel and I left and went to start The Nest. And we ran as an art space for maybe about a year and a half. So programming in the kind of typical way you'd expect of an art space.
Okay.
We had a film festival. We had a radio station that we ran out of our bathroom. We used to run like an artist breakfast. We had a theater program and did that quite successfully for about a year, year and a half. But in the process of doing that, in the process of opening up space and like facilitating these connections between artists and audiences and platforming different newer emerging mediums as well as artists, we became increasingly curious about each other's practices, but also establishing a kind of collaborative something, right?
Okay.
At the time, this like the name collective wasn't really within our reach because it wasn't a thing that we're thinking about, but we're just like, you know, everyone at the team, I think the starting team, we must have been maybe 6 or 5.
Okay.
Everyone already had a medium that they worked in or they were curious about a medium.
Yeah.
And so we're like, what does it look like if we just sort of like make work together, right? And remembering that the kind of like founding four, there was already a collaborative and a working dynamic previous to the collective. So they're already like, you know, like the foundation was there to make work together. And so in 2013, we made our first kind of like piece of collective work, which was a series of nine or eight fashion films.
Okay.
Which we shot in one day, which terrible idea. All nine in one day. Supposed to be a challenge. And we were most certainly challenged. But it was incredible because we really sort of like pushed ourselves and we made all the films in a day. It's called Chicoleco Presents. And I think that exercise was really useful and critical for us because it allowed for that dynamic to really crystallize. And we're like, okay, we can actually work together. And like the process is fairly seamless. And we still, you know, at the end of the process, we still like each other. And I think that really gave us confidence to make more work together. Because shortly after that, then we set out to do Stories of Our Lives, which I think, looking at the history of the collective and the journey of the collective, Stories of Our Lives is quite a pivotal work because it really solidified the collective and the identity of the collective and the kind of internal relationships.
And speaking of the Stories of Our Lives, you traveled across the country in 2013 to record over 250 anonymous audio interviews to build an archive of undercover queer Kenyan lives. And out of that massive oral history project, a film was made, so powerful that it was shown in 90 countries and won the prestigious Berlinale Jury Prize, all the while banned in your home country for promoting homosexuality. Were you taken by surprise by the massive response to this project? And how did it land for you back home?
To give a little bit of background about Stories of Our Lives and the kind of origin of it, is we were always really dissatisfied with the kind of narrative surrounding the experience and livelihoods and existence of queer people across the African continent. There's always this idea and this narrative that's pushed that queerness is somehow an African and that somehow queer Africans don't exist. There's a very deliberate attempt to erase queer Africans. And that on the other side of the world, the global north has a tendency of reducing the experience of queer Africans to an experience that's just kind of marked with suffering and disease and struggle. And while that's true in many parts of the continent, especially places where queerness remains illegal or punishable by law, those elements certainly exist, but there's so much more to the human experience, the queer human experience. And that's the kind of nuance we wanted to bring into the discussion and into the discourse. And a number of us within the collective identify as queer. And, you know, we're like, we know that there's more to the community than this. And so let's go out in the country and speak to people who identify as queer and be like, hey, these are queer Kenyans who you claim don't exist. So over, I think, a three-month period, we went around the country and interviewed, like, yeah, I think the first round of interviews was about 250 people. Then we did another round of interviews, maybe like 2017, 2018, somewhere there. And that was about another 100 interviews. And then we did another one in maybe 2022. And that was like another, I think, 80 interviews. So the kind of archival Stories of Our Lives is easily kind of like around 450 stories. But that initial exercise of the 250 stories was, just as an exercise itself, for us internally, so incredible because we, again, sometimes there's this idea that queerness is only located within urban contexts. That's something that we were really intentional about venturing out of primarily urban areas. And so, yes, we did interviews in Nairobi, but we also went to Kilifi, we went to Malindi, we went to Kisii, we went to Naivasha, we went to Nakuru, to be able to capture as robust a picture as we possibly could.
Wow, that's like a proper representative sample, right?
Yeah, we thought so, and we still think so. And so we collected these stories, and part of the intention for us was also to be able to give the stories back to the community, because I think as a queer person growing up in Africa, sometimes there can be this feeling that you're the only one, that the queerness is so peculiar, that there's only one like you in the country, on the continent, in the world. And that by offering the stories back to the community is our way of saying there's a lot more of us. And that you're not alone, and becomes a reference. It becomes something for the community to see themselves displayed and portrayed in a way that's dignifying. Because that's not always the case. And that certainly wasn't the case.
Wow. And how did you set about finding the subjects to interview to get to a list of 400?
Through our personal networks, you know. It's like asking a friend to ask a friend. And so we worked with a few organizations who work within the space. And then, yeah, leveraged personal relationships and did the reach out and did the interviews. Initially, the plan was to make a book, right? We wanted to collect the stories, put them into a book, and put them into the communities who shared the stories with us. very generously. As we were collecting these stories, a number of them lent themselves super, super visually. Like you're sitting down and hearing someone recount their experience and you're like, this is a movie, right?
Oh, wow.
And this is where the idea to make the film came. And when we're thinking about making the film, we knew obviously the subject was taboo, but we never really expected a ban, right? Because we're really careful around what was going into the film. So there was no nudity. Everything was really considered and very, very PG. Mm. So the ban was incredibly disappointing because, one, it denied us the opportunity to show this film to the people who shared their stories. And, you know, the reason for the ban that we're given was promoting homosexuality.
Okay, which is illegal in Kenya.
Yeah. I remember the guys at the board, they were like, you know, the film is really beautiful, but we need for there to be a discouragement at the end of the film, right? To be like, okay, yes. So at the end of the film, there's like a warning or a disclaimer that warns people against homosexuality or that really, yeah, discourages people. And they're like, if you add that into the film, then, you know, we'd be more than happy to let you guys go in the film. And obviously we had no interest in doing that. And so 14 years on, we still haven't been able to screen the film back home, which, wow, again, for us is incredibly disappointing. Okay. But we were able to make the book. And so I remember the first print run of the book, before even launching and publicizing, we sent the book to, again, the community that we got stories from so they could have access to the material, even in case it was banned. It was still within those spaces. But yeah, at least we got the book out.
So you were able to make a book, but you couldn't distribute the movie.
Yeah.
And that's because the law is different between how books are regulated and film and literature.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow.
Quite.
And I suppose, I mean, you said 14 years later, the film is still banned.
It is.
And you talk a lot about the erasure of, you know, African stories, African people, and in this case, of queer people. Mm. How does it feel for you to still deal with the fact that the film is still banned in your home country?
I keep on going back to the word disappointing. Hmm. I think it's disappointing that the kind of the board and the state feels or believes that adults or, like, you know, people who are able to reason can be so compelled by a film and suddenly become queer, right? Hmm. This idea of promoting homosexuality for me is almost comical. Like, I'm trying to understand the real risk and the thing that they're trying to avoid, right? I remember there was a time where we were even hoping that they would have given the film a rating of like no under 18.
Yeah,
that would have been, or like adults only, right? Still not great, but a little bit more understandable. But just like an outright ban also, it just limits any possible discussion, right? Mm. And we saw the same thing with Rafiki. And Rafiki actually went to court and they appealed that decision. And they finally actually won the case. I think it was maybe earlier this year.
Mm, wow.
But they were in
court after many years.
8 years. Yeah. Right? And I think that the question there around what bans actually do, they limit the conversation that can be had within the spaces. And it's just, it's really unfortunate.
And they tend to be unproductive, right? They tend to have the opposite effect of what they try to achieve because, as dysfunctional and frustrating as it is, they also highlight that you cannot put a ban on human behavior. Human beings are going to do what human beings are going to do.
Yeah.
Exactly. But after Stories of Our Lives came more films. So To Catch a Dream, directed by Jim Chuchu, Tukumacho, and then came Not African Enough. Mm-hmm. I love that title. And most recently, there's been your work in the Netherlands for the apparently amazing Biennale State of Fashion. Mm-hmm. Tell us about State of Fashion.
State of Fashion is quite recent. So as of now, I'm a part of the Creative Advisory Council for this year's edition.
Which Congratulations.
Thank you. We just opened in Arnhem in the Netherlands in May, actually. So like earlier in May. And previous to that, I was part of the curatorial team for Ties That Bind. What that meant is, for Ties That Bind, the lead curators, Rachel and Louise, were really interested in decentralizing this model of the Biennale, which for me is something that's really compelling and I think is really necessary, because when you think about Biennales, when you think about art fairs and sort of like cultural events, they tend to be located overwhelmingly in the kind of global north. And that kind of raises questions around access and who gets the joy and the privilege of seeing, I like to say, African excellence, right? And that I think it's really important for us to create platforms and moments for Africans to be able to see African excellence on the African continent and not have to go and see it in Paris or London or wherever. And that's, for me, what this decentralized model was offering, was giving me an opportunity to stage an exhibition in Nairobi for Kenyans and other Africans to see African excellence, African design excellence within their context. Because then it translates in a way that's so different, right? I think it's one thing to see African design excellence in a French museum. I think it's another thing to see it in Nairobi, right? The context has shifted, the way that people are interacting with the work has shifted. And so that's what I did, you know, staged an exhibition in Nairobi as part of State of Fashion, and then contributed to the larger exhibition in Arnhem.
I see. So
like a two-part.
Incredible. So you have an incredible body of work for someone who's not yet 40, right? You haven't even reached the age of 40.
Not yet.
What have been some of the most significant detours or personal challenges along the way?
So sometimes I feel like my career feels like a series of side quests, right?
Okay. Of side quests. Okay.
Only because I'm led by questions.
Oh, wow.
Right? And whatever question feels urgent at any given time, I'll pursue it. And which is why, like, I think even going back to this thing of title, whether I'm like curator, creative director, photographer, a production designer, I think all of those things are me kind of side questing, where I'm like, okay, I need to understand something, right? And so I'll take this assignment, I'll take this job, because it'll help me answer this question. It'll help me satisfy this curiosity. And maybe that'll birth something later on, and maybe not. And so I've kind of done a little bit of everything, to be honest. But yeah, if there was a through line, if there was a common thread that kind of runs through everything, there's always a question. And sometimes the questions are interconnected, sometimes they aren't. But I also think that sometimes I wonder if I was just kind of loyal to one medium or one format and just commit to it for an extended period of time, what that would look like. I think sometimes this kind of like moving between mediums can feel like a detour in and of itself, because it feels like you're almost being disloyal or restless, just sort of like constantly moving. And so that feels like I guess you can make a case for and against, depending on how you want to look at it from. I think the other thing is, it's always been a little bit difficult for me to pinpoint like someone else's trajectory, or like a trajectory to be like, I want to be like so-and-so,
sure,
right? Because sometimes I feel like in the arts, or just like in life in general, a lot of people will have someone they look up to, like someone's trajectory. They're like, I want to have that similar trajectory. And I guess this is also tied back to this sort of like moving around, right? So I guess there's a few different people who I deeply admire what they've done. I deeply admire how they approach things and how they think about things. But like a single person, I've never really been able to find.
Okay.
And so sometimes the way that feels like is, it can feel sometimes like I'm moving like a little bit blindly and like a little bit unsure of like the next step and if it's the right thing. And so I can also spend a lot of time kind of questioning my decisions and my choices about what to pursue.
I can talk about this all day. I love this idea that your life is led by a series of questions, and that's how you decide what to do next, because I think we had an interesting conversation at dinner last night about, if you're at university today, how do you navigate this new world with AI?
Yeah.
Is the knowledge in the university, which is the relationship we used to have with academia in the past, or is the knowledge out there? Mm-hmm. But I think that's such an incredible answer to that if you're led by question, then you will find your path wherever that leads.
Yes, wherever that leads.
And to have the courage as well to not define your path. And I like how you say you have admired different people at certain times, and that has changed over time as well. But are there some people, icons that you deeply admire and you can think of today, or is it not a specific person?
I mean, gosh, it depends on how much time you have. There's a curator at the V&A, her name is Dr. Christine Chakinska, who had the privilege of working for the Africa Fashion Exhibition at the V&A in 2022. And I'm such a fan of Christine. I think that the way that she thinks about things is so beautiful and so sensitive.
Wow.
There's a tenderness in her methodology that, for me, is just, it's so compelling, it's so strong. And yeah, it's always like such a joy to speak to her, to think alongside her and to make work with her. Like staging that exhibition was incredible purely because of that. And so she's someone that I hold in quite high regard. The late Koyo Ko, huge fan of Koyo's work and her philosophies. I had the privilege of meeting her maybe like once or twice. I forget the year, once she was in Nairobi. That kind of fierce clarity.
Yeah.
It's just, for me, it was always like so mind-blowing. I feel like you had an exchange with Koyo and you left feeling so re-energized.
Incredible.
And you left with such clarity about what you were supposed to be doing and your purpose, right? Because also she was never one to shy away from like calling you out if you were sort of like, you know, veering off your path. And so I think of Koyo. Let's go with those two for now, and sure...
That's very beautiful. I mean, and with Koyo, her work continues, right?
Yeah.
And it continues even at this year's Biennale.
Yes.
So talk to us about your relationship with beauty. I know you did a project on decolonizing design, and in 2022, one of your projects was called In Their Finest Robes, The Children Shall Return, where you had 55 models and 55 outfits from 55 countries. Mm-hmm. Which is a groundbreaking large-scale installation via performance and film showcased globally and notably in London's V&A Museum. So talk to us about how this came about and what it entailed.
That's a two-parter. I'll start with the first one. So my relationship with beauty is expansive and continues to evolve. I find, and I'm guilty of the same thing, but I've found that people are often reluctant to admit or to own a kind of fascination with beauty because it's perceived as either shallow or superficial or vain, right? And so I've found in myself sometimes a slight reluctance to admit or own my own fascination with beauty. But as I've grown older and hopefully wiser, that reluctance has reduced. I think for me, I find that beauty and like experiencing beauty is very close to a kind of sacred experience.
Yeah.
I think I would go as far as saying that in moments of witnessing beauty, I think we see God. I think you look God in the eyes, right? And I say this knowing that beauty is highly subjective and quite varied for different people. But I think there's something about watching a beautiful sunset or hearing a beautiful sound or smelling a beautiful fragrance, that there's just something so incredibly moving about that moment that for me, it can only be sacred. Mm. That for me is sacred experience. And so I think aesthetics and beauty and kind of like the power of the two are a constant for me. I think also that being Black, being African, being queer, beauty and the dignity of beauty is not something that's always extended to me.
The dignity of beauty.
Right. And that through my work, through our work, there's an opportunity to dignify myself and to dignify each other by extension, by rendering us as beautiful. As African, as Black African people, I think we are well aware of the kind of dehumanizing portrayals that we've seen time and time again, and how dehumanizing they are. And in that context, then beauty becomes such a protest. It becomes like an act of reclamation and it becomes an act of protest. And so I move with that awareness that in some ways, as superficial as people might think it is, that beauty is also quite radical and quite a powerful tool. And to the second part of the question, so this work called In the Finest Robes, The Children Shall Return was a work that I developed for the Ngola Biennial in Sao Tome in 2019. Started developing the work in 2018. Again, this thing of being guided by questions. I was invited to create a work for the biennial. I knew there was going to be fashion related, but it was like super loose in my mind. So I remember the first sort of like recce trip was like February of that year. And I went to the island and just sort of like spent time moving around, looking at spaces. And I had some loose thoughts, but nothing concrete, nothing really stuck. And I went back to Nairobi. But on my trip out, so sort of like on my way to the airport, this idea came to me so fully formed that I like to say that like the land dictated, like the place dictated what needed to be done.
Okay.
Because the idea, the thought arrived so fully formed, right? That I strongly believe that there was other influences, right? And the ambition of the work is so large, because on one hand, one of the things that I've always worked towards and kind of always insisted that we need to expand is when we talk about African fashion, who do we show? Hmm. And there's always this tendency of only looking at the 5-6 countries that tend to dominate that conversation.
True.
But that from a continent of 54, we also have to look elsewhere, right? I've worked in this space for a long time. It's like now going on 20 years working within fashion. But I'm still always reluctant to call myself an expert because my knowledge is limited to like maybe 10 to 12 countries, right? Mm. And that's not even half. And so I'm always quite reluctant to call myself like an African fashion expert because I'm always learning and there's still so much to learn. But I wanted to use this moment to visualize the kind of both breadth and diversity of fashion that you find across the African continent. And so there was this idea to have 54 models, each of them dressed by a designer from each of the 54 countries, and create this performance piece. So from a technical perspective, that was kind of like the ambition to capture the breadth and diversity. But the more philosophical and intellectual point was Ghana had just announced the year of return.
Okay.
I think the previous year, around October or November. And I remember thinking about this return and this reconciliation of, it's like a reconciliation of global blacknesses and what that looks like and what it means and how you mark it in a way that acknowledges the hurt that has taken place. Mm. Because when you hear the conversations that happen between sort of like Africans on the continent and like Africans in the diaspora, there's always this tension around the pain caused by slavery and the role of Black Africans in the slave trade, right? Mm. And some people believe that we as Black Africans haven't owned up to our role and how we participated as well. I found myself thinking about the story in the Bible. I think it was Joseph, right? The return of the prodigal son and coming back and being welcomed in the finest robes. Mm. And so I started thinking about this performance piece that was almost like a ritual, because the work starts off with the children. And so all the models are in the water and there's a mediator who was myself kind of mediating between the children, the land and the water as kind of three parties and three entities who were violated during the slave trade and asking for forgiveness, right?
Wow.
That's kind of how the work starts, and like the models move from the water onto the land, and that's sort of like the marking of the return. There's an asking of forgiveness. There's an asking of reconciliation. And the asking of forgiveness was to all three entities because the land was violated, as was the water, as were the children.
Incredible. Wow. Almost like a cleansing ritual.
Yeah.
And tell me about the logistics in getting all these outfits to one place. My brain can't move away from what a mammoth task that could have been.
Mammoth task is right. The logistics were a nightmare. That's it. Easier story to say it. You know, in the end, the ambition was to have 54. I was like 54 plus one to represent the diaspora. And I think in the end, I can't remember how many we ended up with. It was like maybe 40-something. It's because like just a whole bunch of stuff was caught up in customs.
Mm. Yeah.
The shipping fees were so high. They were so high. But more interestingly was the shipping routes. So then I became obsessed with this thing of like watching and like kind of understanding the shipping routes, because from a number of places, the packages left the continent and then came back.
Yeah.
So I remember things were being routed through Paris, through Amsterdam, which, you know, we can go into conversations around like the logistics of moving product on the continent and why it is that in certain cases things have to leave. That's easier and cheaper for things to leave the continent and then come back. Instead of just being shipped directly.
And why the process is not seamless. So
yeah.
I know when I first started chatting to you, I was explaining to you that, I mean, on this podcast, for example, we always try and wear, you know, local fashion designers or designers from the continent, but how challenging it often is to access their clothing or to get their clothing to you on time.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that is a conversation that needs to be had. How do we support African fashion, but how do we make it accessible?
Yeah.
Because I think it is available, but accessing it... is an incredible challenge.
Yeah.
And for those people who can afford, you know, to shop across the globe, how do you make it their first choice to be able to access fashion on the continent?
And it's always access, right? Mm. For as long as it's easier to get to shop online from Zara or H&M, even from Europe, and get it into Nairobi than it is to shop from Lagos and get it to Nairobi, then that'll always be where people lean to.
Mm.
Obviously, this is something the free trade agreement is trying to address.
Correct.
But until that really comes to effect in a way that's felt across the entire continent, but also across the value chain to the consumer, I think it's still, you know, it'll still remain sort of like difficult.
Mm.
And so you have all of these scenarios where people use their friends and family members as mules.
Bring stuff.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So if I know that you're going to Lagos, I'm like, oh God, okay.
Yeah.
Can you pick this up for me? Pick this up for me.
Yeah.
And I just think we have to, like, it needs to be solved. We can't still be having this conversation in 2026.
And I love how you're referencing the fact that if we traded more with each other, these problems would also be indirectly solved through
100%.
That process. So talk to me about sustainability. I know it's a topic very close to your heart, which is the opposite end of the beauty spectrum, unfortunately, with the vast masses of landfill that global fast fashion has created.
Mm.
This was the message of your exhibition, Return to Sender, which was a traveling exhibition of textile waste bales. What strides are you witnessing on the continent in terms of the sustainability issue?
So this issue of waste colonialism, which is actually a term that I think was popularized by the Orr Foundation from Ghana, is quite urgent. And it's urgent for a number of reasons. One, we have this really incredibly problematic power dynamic that exists between, like, the global north and Africa, but also a few other places in the global south who are recipients of this textile waste. And I think back in the 80s, 90s, because for instance, in Kenya, we've been receiving secondhand clothing from as far back as the 80s.
Okay.
And the volume has been steadily increasing year on year on year. Some publication was claiming that Kenya is now the largest importer of secondhand clothing in the world.
Wow.
And so as the volume of this clothing being imported into African countries is continuing to increase, we're also seeing a direct correlation with the kind of decline of local manufacturing within these countries.
Mm.
Kenya used to be a grower and processor of cotton in the 80s and 90s. Fast forward to now, we barely grow any cotton and we're certainly not manufacturing. That's also the case in Uganda and Tanzania, though in Uganda and Tanzania, they have more cotton than we do. So when you look at the stats between sort of like the import and the volume of imports and like local manufacturing, you're able to see the real direct impact of those imports on local manufacturing. So there's that. And I think what's incredibly complex about this conversation around secondhand clothing is sometimes there's a tendency to find a tidy answer of like to say definitively that secondhand clothing is good or secondhand clothing is bad.
Mm.
But I don't believe that it's that easy. And I feel like the reality and like the truth is kind of somewhere in between or kind of both, because it's a sector that's like full of contradictions, right? That on one hand, it's incredibly detrimental both to planet as well as to economy. But at the same time, it's also the primary source for a lot of people who are especially economically marginalized for them to be able to access their clothing, right? So if we have this market and this import as a primary source of people to be able to access a basic need and by extension, a kind of basic dignity, then we also can't say that we have to do away with it or that we should do away with it, because then what comes in its place?
Mm-hmm.
We also have to accept that it's a sector that employs hundreds and thousands of people. Where my interest lies is in really examining this power dynamic where when you really assess the movement of this clothing and the movement of the bales, it's quite opaque, right? Sometimes quite literally, because the bales come wrapped in this. Sometimes the packaging is clear, sometimes it's opaque. And when traders buy the bale, they have no real sense of what's inside.
Mm-mm.
They might know the category of item. They might know that it's a bale of t-shirts, but they don't know the quality of those t-shirts. And so when you really think about it, the purchase of every single bale is a gamble, right? And you're asking people who are already economically marginalized to gamble with their income and their livelihoods by buying this bale. And when we're researching the work, some traders would say that on a good day, they can sell 80% of the bale. So 20% goes to waste. But on a bad day, they'll sell 30% of a bale and 70% goes to waste. And I think for me, that's where the problematics lie, because if 70% of a bale, even let's say 50% of a bale is complete waste and goes directly to landfill, there's really important questions around, one, why waste is being moved between countries, and the kind of principle and ethics of outsourcing waste management from the global north into the global south. Mm. A country like Kenya, where our waste systems and our waste streams are already so burdened, and then we have this influx of like 30, 20, 40% of every single bale is new waste for us to process. And so the question becomes of like, whose responsibility is that? Mm. And what does responsibility look like? On the other hand, it's the impact of this clothing on people's sort of like sense of dress and aesthetic sensibility, but how it starts to distort it. In certain places, secondhand clothing, and actually in most places, secondhand clothing is cheaper than traditional dress. And so that becomes the preferred kind of method of dressing. And so we see this shift from cultural dress to just, you know, secondhand clothing. And that in and of itself is problematic. And also in countries like Ghana, where secondhand clothing has become such a big topic, and rightfully so, but it's also becoming a big topic at the expense of Ghanaian designers who are working within that space. I remember doing, it was a kind of like a test, I can't remember, like 3 months ago, I sort of like Googled fashion in Ghana. And maybe it's changed, but I remember the first like 5 results were tied to secondhand clothing.
Wow.
And for me, that continues to, the cost of secondhand clothing is simply too high. It's detrimental to the economy. It's detrimental to people's sort of like sense of self to a certain extent, certainly to the environment, but also it's erasing local design cultures, such as this example.
Yeah, the economic and psychological cost.
Yeah.
Because what was interesting from what you're saying and listening to is that the origin of all this clothing coming to this part of the world is to actually get rid of it.
Yeah.
And that we then created a secondary market, which is a resale market, so that people can earn some kind of a livelihood to also to feed into people's desire to have this clothing. So its intent is actually not to create a new market for fashion. Mm-hmm. It's the original intent is to get rid of waste.
Yeah.
From the global north, as you say, over to this part of the world. So, yes, I agree with the psychological cost of that as well, and that we're now becoming a dumping ground. Initially, it was food and that type of waste, and now it's become in the fashion sense.
And something you said has made me think of something else, but you know, when we think about sustainability and we think about the labor of sustaining, I think in the global north, people really enjoy talking about sustainability without thinking about the practice of it, like what it means to actually sustain. And what you find across the continent, because it's so cultural, is that we don't necessarily have a culture of discarding. Everything finds a purpose, right? The blue band tin will become a tin.
The kids will play with.
Exactly.
The street.
Or it becomes a container for like soup in the fridge, and then it becomes a container for soap. And similarly, clothing, you know, the t-shirt becomes, it's a t-shirt, it moves down family members when it's being held together by string, or like it's not a t-shirt anymore. Mm. It becomes a dish towel or a rug.
Yeah.
We really are good at extending the life cycle of things. And so there is this expectation that when we receive these clothes, we do the labor of sustaining, but there's no real acknowledgement of what that labor is. Mm. So on one hand, people can talk about sustainability and not practice it.
And our contribution to the sustainability effort by even receiving this clothing in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So on one hand, sustainability is theory. Mm. On our end, sustainability is practice.
Yeah. I mean, so what does sustainability look like in the African sense? Just in terms of redefining what sustainability is, because I agree with you.
Mm.
Even in climate change discussions, people often say, you know, certain things are expensive to entertain in the African context. And I always say, well, I don't think it's that it's expensive. So, for example, do we have complicated recycling practices? Maybe we don't have the color-coded bins, but we have different ways of recycling in this part of the world. And what does a circular model look like inside the side of the world? It's very different to what you'd have in the literature on sustainability. But in and of itself is also a level of sustainability.
100%. I've recently become really obsessed with this idea and question of trying to understand what the indigenous language and vocabulary of sustainability is across the continent.
Mm.
And there's a great researcher, South African researcher called Siviwe James, who did a little talk at Lagos Fashion Week recently. And her talk sort of like touched on this. And I haven't been able to stop thinking about it ever since, because I think that for as long as we are inheriting this language and vocabulary of sustainability from the West,
yeah,
it's not allowing us to have a sort of like more nuanced position about our sustainable practice. And the practice of sustainability is evident. The practice of reuse is evident. We see it in our houses. We see it in like our parents, our mother's inability to throw away a plastic bag, right? And just like...
Like a t-shirt makes an amazing dishcloth, by the way. Our mother's eternal quest for a proper dishcloth does not lie in what you find in the shops. It lies in a torn-up t-shirt.
Exactly. And that all of that, that practice is certainly informed by something. There's a philosophy. There's an older philosophy. And I think there's a language accompanying that philosophy that I'm really curious to discover what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm particularly curious to find out what those philosophies are and understand the essence of them, right? And I know that sometimes the limitation is that maybe that it's in kind of indigenous languages, and so there's no neat translation.
Mm.
But for me, that's the exciting bit. Like these things that like don't translate very neatly, but are like a sort of embodied philosophy, or almost like a thing that you don't really have to think about. It's just like, it's so, even your body knows it. Like when you go to throw away a t-shirt, it feels almost immoral.
Mm.
And so you keep it.
Mm.
You're not able to articulate why it feels so immoral, why it feels so reckless to throw away a piece of clothing. But there's something in you that's aware of that, right? So you keep the t-shirt and maybe you find a friend or a cousin to pass it on to, but you never quite throw it.
Mm.
And that, for me, I'm really interested in finding like the root of those ideas.
Amazing. And on a lighter note, who are your current favorite fashion designers on the continent without leaving out any of your favorite children?
Again, how much time do you have?
All day.
Oh, gosh. The list of designers I like is so long and for such different reasons. The first person is Bubu Ogisi of Imesigo. I think Bubu's whole practice is really driven by this kind of desire to understand African ideologies and philosophies. And she's able to express that through cloth, through garments, and through the kind of materiality of the brand. And so whether this is around spirituality, whether it's around kind of positionality, I think that her work is so articulate in that exploration. And so I'm always quite a fan of what she does. She has such clarity around the exploration of the brand. Another favorite is Katungulu Mwendo, who's a Kenyan designer. Katush, in some ways, is a lot like Bubu because she really looks at indigenous silhouettes and indigenous forms. And she takes it on another side where she looks at those forms and sort of like distills them into an essence and expresses them through like line and structure and form and
incredible,
the kind of like technical detail. And so her work is really... And this is true of quite a number of East African designers, because East Africa aesthetically leans a little bit more minimalist than anywhere else really on the continent.
And why is that, out of interest?
I think there's a couple of reasons. Kenya was a settler colony, and I don't think we talk enough about what it means for a country to be a settler colony.
Mm.
Because the goal for the British, the ambition for the British, was not to leave ever, right? Kenya, and or rather British East Africa, which included Uganda, was meant to be an outpost, right? And so the erasure of culture and kind of aesthetic sensibility was particularly thorough. And we were left with a kind of, I hate to call it, but an almost kind of like English sensibility. And you see it in Kenyans' reluctance to wear too much print or too much color. There's always this thing, right? It's like it can't be too much. You can have a little bit, like an accent, like a little piping, a little detail, but never too much, right? And I think that that's a remnant, that's evidence of that colonial violence on culture.
Yeah. Too much color and too much.
Like it was just like just enough, just a hint.
Yeah. Because Africa is associated with its vibrant color, for example, right?
Yeah.
So
the
more you lean away from that, the more you're associated with, you know, a more colonial sense of style.
Yeah, yeah.
And any other designers that you are currently looking out for on the continent?
So Bubu, Katush, maybe we can go into some footwear. There's a brand called Kerele.
Okay.
Nigerian. Make footwear. Huge, huge fan of everything that they're doing. The work is really experimental and almost like sculptural. Jewelry designers, it's a long list. People like Ami Doshisha, people like Adele Dejac.
Whose jewelry do you have on now? Because I quite like your rings.
So one of them is a Kenyan jewelry designer called Njay, which is a spoon. This one, I can't remember who I got it from. I must have stolen it from a friend of mine, which I shouldn't be admitting out loud. So, and then this, I got in Addis.
Amazing. Well, you have an incredible sense of style, as we can tell. But what is your everyday sense of style like? And who do you wear mostly?
So my relationship with clothing has evolved quite a bit. And I've been working within this fashion space for the past, like, going on 20 years, which is a long time. And when I got into fashion, I think I was really interested and I was really committed to performing the role of a person who's interested in fashion. And so I was very aware of the performance that was expected of me and that I was dressing for others and never really for myself. And maybe about 10 years ago, I hit a point where I really wanted to recalibrate that performance. And I wasn't really interested in performing for anyone anymore. And I became a lot more interested in what performing for myself would look like. And so I kind of went through this period where all I wore was black, which was a great period, as I kind of reassessed what performing for myself would look like. And I think that's the thing with fashion, right? Is that, like, I think people are always quite anxious about performance and the performance that's required.
True.
But I think that fashion requires performance. It's how you activate it. Like, you activate dress by performance, right? And that in the absence of performance, or when, like, performance is lacking, then there's a discrepancy that arises. So for instance, if you're going for a job interview and you're wearing a suit and you're sort of like hunched over, then the performance is unconvincing. You need to perform the role of, you know, if you're wearing a suit, there's a correlating performance that's expected of you. So I went through this period of only wearing black as a kind of recalibrated my relationship with clothing, who I wanted to dress for, and what that it looked like. And I also just wanted to understand clothing on a more fundamental level. I'm a little bit of a nerd in that this thing of, like, always being led by questions. So I think I was asking myself, like, what actually is clothing? What is clothing for me in my life? Like, beyond just covering nakedness, what actually do I want to use clothing to do? And as a medium, I find clothing incredibly powerful. And even for the people who kind of say that they don't like clothing, or they're not interested in clothing, or they're unwilling to participate in fashion, by opting out of participating, then they're still participating, right?
Yep.
So I did this extensive thought exercise. And I suppose where it's landed me now is I'm super aware of how I instrumentalize clothing. Sometimes I'm interested in performance and I can perform what's expected of me. But sometimes I abandon performance and I refuse to participate. But even in the refusal to participate, I'm aware of how I'm participating. And I guess what that looks like for me on a day-to-day, my kind of go-tos are, like, I'm a huge fan of Katush, who I mentioned, from Kenya. I'm a huge fan of This Is Us, Nigerian brand. And the thing that is the through line between the two of them is that I feel really comfortable. And I never, ever thought in my life that comfort would be a driving factor.
Yeah,
in deciding, you know, who I'm buying or where I'm buying from. But I also, because of the kind of work I do, sometimes I'm quite happy to just sort of, like, disappear into the background. And I utilize clothing that allows me to do that. And so I'll always look presentable, never unkempt or, you know, sloppy, but not the one pulling focus. And when I want to pull focus, then I know how to do it.
And what is your sense of style on the African continent? So moving away from the designers, and which countries have some of the best style for you? Just off the top of your head, I'm now curious to see how you see the rest of us.
I love the style in Lagos. I think that Nigerians are really unashamed of their love for clothing and their love of performance. And that for me is just so hypnotizing to witness a kind of peacocking in public space. I can only liken it to peacocking, right?
Yes, yes.
And it's incredibly effective, right? The style in Johannesburg is really interesting because it has a very strong performance, But then the style choices and the styling is so specific.
I was about to use the word as well, specific.
Yeah, it's very specific. Like, you can always see someone and be like, are you from here? So those two come to mind immediately. And because I like threes, I'll pick a third. Okay, I'll say Nairobi.
You have to say Nairobi.
I'll say Nairobi. And obviously, I think this is because of my proximity and my location within that space that I'm able to observe how the sensibility has evolved and how Kenyans continue to test the sort of like ideas through clothing. Mm. So this idea of Kenyanness and sort of like unified national identity or sort of like unified signal of Kenyan nationality doesn't exist. So we don't have a national dress, which means that Kenyans are always trying to find an approximation of some sort of a signal that allows them to sort of like hold space somewhere in the public that's able to wear a garment or an item can speak of their Kenyanness without them having to vocalize it. And so over the years, this is like this just sort of like continuous testing of like, okay, what'll hold? And there's been kind of like search for a national dress has been 3 attempts so far. But there's a kind of interesting placeholder that's emerged, which is this like beaded Kenyan bracelet, right?
Okay, yeah.
And I love that bracelet so much because it's so unassuming as an object and it's so simple, but it's so powerful.
Yes.
And for me, as an object, it makes complete sense because when you look at Kenyan dress culture, is that Kenyan dress culture the culture of adornment, not of cloth. Across every single ethnic and cultural group in Kenya, the thing that's central is adornment. Like, it's almost like the Kenyan view of dress is to first look at the naked body and then to articulate it through adornment. Mm. And so to have, I don't know how many years later, to have this like small piece of adornment that's able to work so effectively, but it's also a piece of adornment, feels so indigenous, right? And true to that sort of like Kenyan essence. And so I guess, yeah, Kenya, Nairobi for me is interesting because of the kind of continuous testing and an attempt to build a kind of national visual.
And speak to me about the Maasai traditional attire and how recognizable it's become. Any feelings on the Maasai style that's become so, popularized or made visible on the international stage?
Maasai cultural dress is incredible, but it's also quite similar to a lot of kind of pastoralist cultural dress. Mm. So there's some similarities with the Samburu, there's some similarities a little bit with the Turkana, there's some similarities with the Rendile. And sometimes there's a little bit of a conflation when people
talk about
Maasai dress. Mm. It's like they'll, use some elements from Samburu and still call it Maasai. Mm. They'll use beading techniques from the Rendile or the Maasai and or the Samburu and still call it Maasai. And I think that that's unfortunate because it means that there's other dress cultures that are kind of like being co-opted into this visual and not being given the credit that they deserve. That said, I think it's both good and bad. I think the popularity of that kind of like visual of the Maasai is really useful for Kenya as a tourist destination. It allows for Kenya to position itself a certain way. And it's a very effective visual because the minute that you see the Maasai, you immediately think of Kenya. That said, I also think the downside of it is that it kind of flattens the variety of culture that you find in Kenya. I think there's people in the world who think that only the Maasai live in Kenya and are unaware of the other 44 tribes who also live in Kenya and call Kenya home. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, I'd say.
Which speaks to the challenge you mentioned previously about why it's so difficult to come up with this with one specific national dress code for Kenyans, because people sometimes are unaware that there's so many tribes living in Kenya. So I think that's incredible. But I think for me, that's why I love your body of work, Sunny, because it's so nuanced about Africa and what African identity looks like and how it presents and how it chooses to present at times. And sometimes it's not always what is dictated by traditional dress and that distinction. So I know you've done some work on the wax print and how it came to be, a very prevalent textile across the continent. So within Nigeria, here in South Africa as well.
Yeah.
But I like how you explain it across the board, because there are very few explanations that exist in the world. And that's why I suppose we end up with this definition of Kenyan dress being associated with the Maasai.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things that, again, I'm a huge, huge advocate for, and I always will try and do in everything that I make and put out into the world, is to encourage us to expand our definitions of what these things are. When we think of African fashion, I think immediately people think of, like, the kind of words that come into people's minds are colorful, patterned, vibrant. And I think that's certainly true of other parts of the continent, but I don't think that it's representative of the entire continent.
Mm.
And by only using those three words to define African fashion, then we leave other people out. So countries like Kenya or Uganda that might perhaps lean a little bit more restrained when it comes to color or print are left out of that of those descriptors, right? Mm. So I'll always make a case for us to expand our understanding and knowledge of African design, African aesthetic, kind of like aesthetic sensibilities, African music, African film, because it's so expansive.
Mm.
And it would be such a disservice if I, as an African, kind of use the same language and wasn't working actively to expand, to make room and make sure that people are looking farther and looking harder to see the whole of the continent as opposed to the 3-4 places that they're used to looking at.
Mm. And finally, Sunny, what conversations do you think as African creators we should be having about the future of fashion?
That's a big question. I think fashion is interesting as a medium in that it's a medium that people use for self-expression, but it also has this really strong commercial element, right? And so depending on who you're speaking to, some people will lean a little bit more commercially and they're looking at the kind of numbers of people who are employed in the sector, the kind of revenues of the sector is generating, and how we optimize systems to be able to grow that sector and grow those numbers of people employed and of revenue that the industry is making. On the other hand, it's this repository of indigenous knowledge, and in a sense, it's a form of inheritance. I always say that heritage is our inheritance. Mm. One of the things that we have access to that when we are born in this space as Africans. And it speaks for us. It speaks of who we are, how we see ourselves, how we want to be seen. And that fashion, like African fashion designers, for the most part, are kind of trying to balance this of protecting heritage or speaking to heritage and people's kind of being and belonging, but also having a commercial venture. And I think that seeing that is really important.
Mm.
I always feel like designers across the continent aren't given the credit they deserve around the work that they're doing of cultural preservation, because they're doing it as a single entity, right? Mm. We know that indigenous knowledge, especially artisanal knowledge, requires the kind of capitalistic incentive to stay alive and to stay accessible. And that's an incentive at the moment is primarily being given by these designers. When This Is Us are going to Kano and working with the indigo dyers in Kano, they're providing incentive for that heritage and that knowledge to stay alive, right? And so that heritage is staying alive because of designers like This Is Us and Amisigo and everyone who's sort of like going to Kano. And I wish that people could see that a little bit clearly, right? Because then a dress is not just a dress. It is, but it's also a little bit more, right? Especially if it's using these materials and these knowledges and these skills. And I've forgotten the other thing I was going to say.
Well, that's a good place to end, to give you a rest. Sunny Durlett, thank you for making sure that we are all African enough. Thank you for being on the African Imaginary Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a great privilege chatting to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.